Hello, everybody. Welcome to Lecture 5. This past weekend, I was away at a conference in San Diego called Libertopia. I was a bit nervous about going to the conference because the MC for the conference, fortunately, he wasn't the one who was introducing my lecture, was someone I'd done an extremely negative book review of this person's work, and he has a website, and various of his followers were very strongly against me, so I was anxious not to have any encounter with him, and I managed to avoid it. I was glad of that. That has nothing to do with this course, but I just thought I'd throw it in anyway. All right. Now, today, those of you who read Chapter 4, you no doubt notice it's a very short chapter, but it has some very important stuff in it. So I think if you go through this chapter very carefully, you'll get some of the key concepts that'll enable you to understand the first part of human action better. And, you know, the premise of our course is you need to understand part one of human action to understand the whole book, to understand what Mises is saying. But I first want to get, wait, this didn't, let me just check at this. Yet I want to deal with a point that was raised by one of the students, Robin Hart Bunting, whom I've seen at many Mises conferences. He's an Irish philosopher. He raised an interesting question about something Mises said. Remember that Mises said action stems from felt uneasiness, that as Mises saw matters, why do we act? Well, we're dissatisfied with the situation we're in, or more exactly, with the situation that we would be in if we didn't act. So we're dissatisfied, and then we act to relieve this dissatisfaction. So Robin noted that Ayn Rand criticized Mises for saying that we act from felt uneasiness. She thought, well, there are some times when people do act because they want to relieve some uneasiness, but she thought that Mises was the victim of a negative death-avoiding psychology. As she was looking at things, Mises was saying, well, we're acting because we want to relieve some kind of stress. We're uneasy and we're stressed out, so we want to act to relieve this. And she, when she speaks of death avoiding, but perhaps she has in mind the famous claim by Hobbes that the dominant passion in people's lives is the fear of violent death. So what she says, well, can't we be motivated by joy rather than uneasiness? Can't we decide to act by doing something we like? Supposing, say, I go to a nice restaurant, I want to have dinner, so can I be motivated by the thought I'd really like to eat dinner rather than I'm uneasy, I'm feeling bad because I'm hungry, so I'm going in to relieve my hunger. But this is criticism that Rand raised, that Mises has a negative psychology because he's talking about felt uneasiness as a condition for action, is really based on a misunderstanding of what Mises meant. We can see this if we recall a very important fact of what is it that we're doing in praxeology, in this study of human action. And remember, according to Mises, we're giving the form of all action. We're saying, what is it that an action has in common with every other action? What are the general characteristics of every action? We're not dealing with the content of particular action. So we would say, for example, any action involves the use of means to achieve an end, but we wouldn't be saying, talk about particular actions like my giving a lecture, or your listening to the lecture, or your turning off your lecture and going to something else. So we wouldn't be concerned with particular actions. Now, why did I mention that? Well, Rand, in making this criticism, she must be taking felt uneasiness to be some kind of feeling we have. Like sometimes we feel uneasy about things. I always get nervous, say, when I have to give a lecture or do something. Sometimes things make me uneasy. So we do feel uneasy in this way sometimes, but that's a particular psychological fact that comes about in certain actions. It's not a general characteristic of all actions. So what I think is essential to see is we have to take felt uneasiness, as Mises uses it, in so it's consistent with this view of praxeology, where we're just giving the general form of an action. So if we do that, we can't take uneasiness in the sense of feeling bad. We have to take it in a purely formal sense. And it just means that the actor, the person who's acting, thinks that he can do something to improve his situation. So it's not as if we have to feel bad in some way in order to act, but we just have to think we can improve things, and that's consistent with feeling very happy about things or feeling elated. It doesn't matter what our psychological state is. It's that the condition for action is, or a condition for action is, we have to believe that we can change things for the better. Similarly, I see Brian says, raises the point that about happiness, remember, Mises is also taking happiness in a purely formal sense. It's not some kind of psychological state, but whatever it is we're aiming at counts as happy. So I hope I've relieved, or at least alleviated, whatever felt uneasiness you may have had about the concept of felt uneasiness. Now, it is a bit odd if that was what Mises meant, that he uses the phrase felt uneasiness. But I think perhaps the reason he did that is that he's just carrying over certain terms that earlier economists had used. And some of the British classical economists, particularly those influenced by the utilitarian school, did have a psychological theory where we're acting to relieve uneasiness in the sense of some kind of bad feeling that we have. So there were people who held that view, but Mises shouldn't be taken to be one of them. Now, Mises begins this chapter we have, chapter 4, that we're considering today, a first analysis of the concept of action, with something that we're very familiar with. I just see Danny wants to know, is felt uneasiness a Lockean term? Well, I think you're right. He uses the term. I don't know whether he originates it. I think you'd find it in other people in this school, like Lord Shaftesbury and other people, but Locke certainly uses it. Now, that's interesting. I'd have to check what Locke meant by it. So Mises begins with something we're already familiar with, that an action, in every action we have an end or goal, what one's trying to achieve by the action, and a means is what the actor thinks will enable him to reach the goal. I might say, well, Mies already said that. Why does he keep saying this over and over again? Maybe we're getting sick of talking about ends and means all the time. I mean, after you've said it a few hundred times, why say it again? But I think you'd be making a mistake if you thought that way, because Mies says one thing here that deepens the concept of ends and means. He says that means, when we say something is a means, it's a human category, that means don't exist in the world apart from the way people consider them. So supposing we were listing, say, the physical objects in a room, I wouldn't be able to say just from listing the physical characteristics of objects that any of them were means. I would have to bring in the way people considered them. So supposing, say, I were just describing the room I'm in. Now, I have to be very careful if I wanted to avoid all references to human purposes. Say, I couldn't say I'm looking at a computer, for example, because if you talk about a computer, that involves some references to the purpose people have in having a machine of that kind. If I just wanted to make a purely physical description, I couldn't put in any of these human categories. So means then are something that exists just when people consider physical object in a certain way. And I just give one quotation here from page 92 where Mies says, "External objects are as such only phenomena of the physical universe. It is human meaning and action that transforms them into means." So again, Mies is saying, let's imagine this situation, someone from Mars is coming, doesn't know anything about human beings, he's just looking at the Earth. The person from Mars wouldn't be able to tell what things are used as means, just if he had a physical description of various things that he saw. He'd have to know what meaning people gave to the various objects before he could say they were a means. Now, Mises then generalizes this point. Remember, the point is that a means isn't something out there in the external world by itself, but it just exists in as how human beings characterize the world. We view something, we have to view something as a means, as something that can help us achieve some purpose that we have in order for it to be a means. So he generalizes this point and says this isn't just true about the concept of means, but it's true of praxeology, the science of human action altogether. He says praxeology isn't about the external world apart from human beings. And you would expect it, because after all, praxeology is a study of human action, so you're not going to be able to study human action without human beings. So again, praxeology is about the meaning human beings give to the world. And I think it's important, Mises doesn't specify this right here, but it's important to avoid going to the other extreme here. Remember, what Mies is trying to combat is the view, there's praxeology is about just sort of some, the external world without reference to human beings. He says it's about the meaning we give to the external world. But the mistake that sometimes made is think, well, praxeology is just purely mental. It's just that way, just having to do with ideas we have of things, but that isn't right. It is about ideas, but they're ideas about the external world. It isn't just something all going on in our head. It's the meaning we give to the external world. So you have to keep both of those poles in mind, the meaning we give and the external world. So Mises says here, and give another quotation, praxeologist does not deal with the external world. I think he means it with the external world by itself, but with man's conduct with regard to it. Remember, it's not just our ideas about the external world, although it includes that, but also how we our conduct with regard to it. Now, another point Mises makes here, he's made this point before, but it's extremely important to get this right, because people sometimes miss this. Means is whatever an actor thinks will help him realize his goal. So it doesn't matter if, in fact, the means won't help. Maybe the people sometimes make mistakes. People think supposing, let's say, somebody has cancer and he thinks there's some kind of disease, there's some kind of medicine. Somebody says, well, this will help you. Forget about what the doctors say. This is really the cure for it. So supposing it's just water with a little bit of maybe some flavoring added, it won't help him at all. But if he thinks it is, then that would be a means to his end. He wants to cure himself of cancer. So he takes this substance even though it won't help him. So why does that count as a means? Why is it a means even though in fact it won't do any good? The reason is, well, remember, in praxeology, we're trying to explain how human beings act. So, supposing I'm trying to explain how you act, why you're doing something, what's important would be what you think will help you attain your ends. Even if you're wrong, you're going to be guided by your own thought. So actually this is a very important point in philosophy. We can distinguish in philosophy, I'll just say this is a bit of a, it's not really digression, so it's more sort of a, I think an interesting point related to what Mises is saying. We can distinguish, it certainly there's a difference between saying something is true and I think something is true. I could think all sorts of things are true that aren't true. I could think I'm a great lecturer, but in fact I'm not a good lecturer. So you could certainly distinguish between what someone thinks and what's the case. But from the first person point of view, I can't make this distinction. Because if I think something, I think that that's true, so I won't be able to, I could recognize a distinction in general between my thinking something is true and its being true, but for any particular belief I have, I can't make that distinction while I'm in the first person perspective. So this is why, even if sounds a bit convoluted, but we can make it simpler, let's imagine this person who's taking this medicine for cancer that in fact won't help. Well, he thinks it'll help, and he could recognize his thinking that'll help doesn't imply that it will help, but he can't, while he thinks it'll help, he can't make that distinction in practice, because thinking something will help is just thinking that in fact it will help. So he's not able to make such a distinction. And if you're trying to explain what he's doing, you have to go according to the thoughts in his mind. So again, I put another quotation from Mises. One thing you notice, I always speak of quotations rather than quotes. A lot of people these days will use quote as a noun, but to me, that's unacceptable. I won't fail anybody in the class who does that, but it's just not quite right if you ask me. Unfortunately, nobody did ask me. Okay, so Mises has this quotation that says, in dealing with prices, economics does not ask what things are in the eyes of other people, but only what they are in the meaning of those intent on getting them. So it's important, again, in explaining what somebody's doing or what prices someone is charging, how that person assesses the situation, even if the person is wrong about it. I remember when I was in the Friedrich Hayek's class in philosophy of the social sciences, this is one point he stressed very much. That economics is dealing with the way people conceive of the situation they're in rather than the actual situation apart from their thoughts about it. Now, Mises now makes another point about means. He says, in order to count as a means, if something is, it means it's something that will enable us to achieve our end, it has to be scarce. Now here again, you have to be a bit cautious and careful when you're reading. Just remember when we were talking about felt uneasiness, I said felt uneasiness doesn't have the meaning you might think it does, where you might think, well, it's referring to some kind of psychological state. Like if you're uneasy, it means something like you've got the heebie-jeebies or the willies or you don't feel good. But that isn't what it means. It means just that you think the situation can be improved. So here, in this context, when Mises said means has to be scarce, I don't think he has in mind here the usual meaning, or at least not just the usual meaning. When we say something scarce, that means it's not true that everyone can have as much of it as he wants, no matter how much he wants. So suppose we say gasoline is scarce means people can't have as much gasoline as they want. They have to. That's why it has a price. But what Mises means is more that for something to be a means, for something not to be scarce, I should say, means you wouldn't have to do anything to get it. So for something not to be scarce, I should have put this in the slide, but I didn't, because I'm just going off my rocker. You know, I'm quite old. That happens when you get older. But for something not to be a means, it's you don't have to do anything to get it. It's just there. For example, we need air to live, but normally we don't need to do anything to get the air. So air is a general condition of human welfare, but it wouldn't count as a means because, remember, means is a category of action. You're using the means to attain an end. So if something is just there, you don't have to do anything, just there, it wouldn't be a means because you don't have to do anything. You're not employing it for any purpose, even though you wouldn't be around, say, if there weren't any air. You don't have to do anything to get the air. So that's why a means has to be scarce. Now, Mises now makes another important distinction, and this one is very important to notice because it'll come up in the discussion of more technical economics later in the book. Now, I guess Maury's just saying something easy doesn't take any work. It wouldn't take any work. And, well, it isn't so much that if something is easy to get, it doesn't count as a means. That would still be means. It's just you don't have to do anything at all to get it. So that would count is what makes it not a means. Steve asked, if your end is to fly, don't you need air as a means? Well, you need air in order to fly, but you don't have to do anything to get here. It's just like, we need air in order to live. If your end is to live, you need air, but you don't have to do anything to get the air. So that's why it's not a means. It's just a general condition of human welfare. Okay, so now, Mises says, supposing a good can satisfy someone without combining it with anything else, and it's a consumer's good. So supposing, say, I'm eating an apple, I don't need to combine eating the apple with anything else, so the apple would be a consumer's good. So, on the other hand, supposing a good can satisfy someone only by combining it with other economic goods, then it's a first order producer's good. So suppose I want a sandwich, I have to have, say, to get it, I have to put together two pieces of bread and then whatever I want to go make up the sandwich. So I have to combine all those to get my sandwich. I say, just by the way, do you know what a Western sandwich is? That's two pieces of bread with nothing but the great plains between them. That was supposed to be a joke. Laughter appreciated. Okay, so if you need to combine a good with other goods to get one of these consumers' goods that's good will directly satisfy someone, then it's a first order producer's good. Then you can reiterate the process. Supposing you want to get make a first order producer's good, you could combine other goods to get that first order goods, so those would be second order goods, and so on. We could keep going further on. We have goods, say you have consumer goods, and you have first order producers' goods that produce those, and you have second order producers' goods which produce the first order producers' goods. And you can keep going that way. And as I say, this is very important, as you'll see later on if you get into the rest of human action. Of course, you have to get through my course first to get to the rest of human action. That's easier said than done. But you'll find this, what's called the structure of production, is extremely important in understanding the Austrian analysis of economics. Now, you might say, have we made an unwarranted assumption? So when I was talking about first order production goods, I said, well, that's you have to combine the goods in order to get the consumer's good. Because if you could just get the satisfaction from directly, then it would be a consumer's good, but you have to combine the producer's good with something else to be get a consumer's good. But then I said, well, then you could have these higher order consumer producers goods where you combine different goods to get a lower order producers goods. Say, imagine we have, let's say I gave you an example, where you have the slices of bread are combined with, say, something else to make a sandwich. Then we could say, well, you could have a higher order good, whatever you need to get the slice of bread. But what is the assumption I've made here is to get a producer's good, you have to get that by combining other goods. So I haven't really given any argument for that. I did give an argument why first order producer's good has to be combined with some other good, because if it weren't, it would be a consumer's good. I didn't give any argument that you couldn't get a producer's good of a higher stage one stage by having one good of a higher stage producing that. Now, as I said, I didn't give an argument for this, but Mises will deal with this later. And he says, and we'll go, I don't think we'll get into the argument in this course, but he says you can't produce a good with only one other good. In order to produce a good, you always need more than one factor production. So in order to get a produce a good, you always have to have a combination of goods. Now, another interesting point, at least I think it's interesting, is that suppose you have something that when you have these higher stages, remember you're having, say, consumers' goods, and you have first-order producers' goods that produce those, and second-order producers' goods. So one among the goods combined in the higher orders, you can take something from the lower orders. Like, say, supposing I said an apple is a consumer's good. So you could take an apple, maybe, and combine it with something else and, say, have a higher order producer's good, use it for something else. So the fact that something is occupies one stage of this structure doesn't follow that it always is on that stage. It just depends on what it is you're going to produce. Now, one point Mises also makes here, and this goes along with what he said earlier. Remember where he said that in praxeology we're not studying what's there in the external world apart from the way we categorize it. We study the meaning that we give things. He said how you place a good in the stage of production sometimes they're going to fix solution. Say, should you, for example, I said apple is the consumer's good. Maybe you should take the consumer's good is the feeling you get when you're eating the apple, and you should take the apple plus you're eating it to be the producer's good that gives you this feeling, this enjoyable taste that you like. And he says, well, it doesn't really matter how you classify this. We shouldn't take these stages or something really fixed and immutable, so there's a definite right answer to them. We just have to get the general idea of stages of production. We start have a consumer's good and then the producer's good. They're used to make them, and then we have higher order producer's good and so on to make those, but it doesn't matter the particular details of how we fill in the structure. At least for the purpose of praxeology, it doesn't matter. Now, Mises then turns, he's talking now about ends and means and something about producers and consumers. Now he gets to another very important topic, the scale of values. He said, when we act, we're choosing among alternatives. We're saying which of the various choices available is the one that we want. So say again, I have to choose, do I want to give this lecture or do I want to do something else? Well, I chose to give the lecture. I won't. If I said, well, I don't feel like giving the lecture today, I wouldn't get my salary, so I better do it, you see. So I chose to do that one, but we always face alternatives. So we can, if we want, and it's sometimes very often useful to do this, say that the actor has a scale of alternatives, ranking the alternatives. So I could say, well, my first rank is to give the lecture. Second rank, say, is to take an afternoon nap. Third rank is to, say, eat an apple. Fourth rank, I'm not going to say. That would get me into too much trouble. So I could say I have a scale of alternatives. I'm choosing the one that ranks highest. But Mises makes a very important point about this scale. He says this scale doesn't exist apart from the actor's behavior. So remember, this ties in with what I said before. I said praxeology isn't just about things going on in the mind. It's about how we're thinking about the real world out there. So the scale of values isn't something that exists apart from the actor's behavior. So it wouldn't make sense, according to Mises, to say that a person did not choose his highest ranking preference. Suppose somebody argued in this way, and there are people who do this, people say, well, imagine the person just has in his mind a list of choices. So supposing I make my list, supposing taking an afternoon nap ranked higher than giving the lecture. So I just had this ranking. So in the view of some people, it makes sense to say I didn't choose my highest ranking goal when I lectured because I preferred taking a nap. That was number one on the scale, but I did something else, namely giving the lecture instead. Because Mises said, well, the scale, if you say that, that is assuming that the scale is somehow there in my mind apart from the action. But it isn't that since I gave the lecture, the scale exists only in the action. So the action I did just is my highest ranking action. Mises, in saying it's the highest ranking choice, isn't giving additional content to saying that I chose something. That's just a way of characterizing the action. So we shouldn't think of the scale of values as existing apart from the actual choice, so that we have no room to raise the question, did someone actually pick his highest ranking choice? We just get what the highest ranking choice is from what the person actually did. Okay, so again, Mises reiterates a point I've already mentioned, but now he takes it in a different direction, different but related direction. And the point we've already mentioned is when we're trying to explain an action, what's important is what the actor prefers. So remember, I said before that suppose you regard something as a means, then you're taking it as a means is what counts. It doesn't matter whether you're right about it. And when Mises said that, incidentally, he was being somewhat critical of Karl Menger, because Menger asked the question, does something actually work if you're thinking of it as a means? But in Mises' view, that isn't a relevant question when you're trying to explain someone's action. So now what Mises applies this same point to ends, to goals. He says, if you're trying to explain an action, what's important is what the actor prefers. So praxeology, study of human action, is not a normative discipline which is telling us what we should choose. So supposing, let's imagine, say somebody is extremely heavy, the person just likes to eat all day, and somebody says, well, that isn't a good way, you shouldn't do that, this is very bad for your health. Or we could say, imagine somebody just likes killing people, he just goes around shooting people. So what would be important in explaining what that person is doing is just what that person wants. Praxeology isn't saying what the person should do or shouldn't do. It's just saying, taking the person's ends as given, and then because that's what's relevant to explain the person's behavior. Now, means says we could evaluate means as suitable or unsuitable to attain them. Remember, here we're not contradicting what we said before. We said before was it in explaining someone's action, somebody takes something to be a means, that's what's important in explaining his action. So again, give my example. Someone says drink some substance that's really just a little colored water because he thinks it'll cure him of cancer, but he's wrong, but that's still a mean because he thinks it's a mean. But we could still, if we wanted, we could evaluate the means as suitable or unsuitable. We could say that isn't suitable to attain the end. He won't get better from cancer by using that, even though he thinks he will. We could do that. That's still within praxeology. We can evaluate the means as suitable or unsuitable. But an ultimate end can't be evaluated. Sometimes we want something, we have something as an end. Suppose I said, I have a goal of studying, learning something about praxeology, so my means is to read human action. So the goal is to understand praxeology, and the means is to read human action. But it could be, if you want to say, well, why do I want to learn about praxeology, it might be that there's some further end that I have. Maybe I just want to be informed about the world. And we could keep asking for various ends, is that a means to a further end? But if we come to a point where we reach an end that isn't a means to some other end, it's just an ultimate end, meaning it's not a means to something else, then Mises says, well, we can't evaluate that. And why not? Because as Mises is taking things, we could only say that something is suitable or not suitable to attain a given end. But if it isn't a means to any other end, then we can't say that. The end is just there. And Mises says, we can't make any evaluation of it. Of course, you might like it or not like it. You might say that isn't an end I would have, but we wouldn't be saying in any objective sense, according to Mises, that it's good or bad. Now, Mises goes further. Well, I said so far I should have clarified this bit better, or much better than I did. When Mises says that we can't say about an ultimate end that's an end that isn't a means to some other end, we can't evaluate it. Sure, the strict meaning is economics or praxeology can't do that. You might have all sorts of theories about what are the objectively good ends? What is the nature of the good life? But praxeology is an normative discipline, so your evaluations wouldn't be part of praxeology. But Mises, in fact, goes further than this. He says it's not only that you can't, within economics, evaluate an ultimate end. He doesn't think that there are any objectively good ultimate ends. And there are many philosophers who do think this, but Mises thinks they're all mistaken. So he doesn't go in for this. Now, Maury asks, wouldn't it be better to say that the ultimate end of any single action is subjectively evaluated by the individual? Well, you're certainly right that the individual just has certain things as an ultimate end, takes something to be his ultimate end. I think that isn't different from what Mises said. All Mises is saying is we can't say anything further than that in his view, at least within economics. And he thinks, in fact, even outside of economics, you can't say anything further. And I have another quotation where he gives, he says, value is not intrinsic. So what would be to say something is value is intrinsic? That would be saying something is good or bad just in itself. It doesn't matter if something, whether people think it's good or not, it just is good. So he says value is not intrinsic, it's not in things, it's within us, the way in which man reacts to conditions of his environment. And I just see a question, I will say mostly for this discussion, it's an interesting question. David says, if ultimate ends cannot be objectively good, how could we have law? Well, I guess one way would be you take law as a means to achieve particular ends that were widely shared among people. That would be, I think, one answer to that. Now, I should say, I'm getting to that in this slide, so I'll just deal with that when it comes up. Now, as you might expect from what I said so far, where Mises is saying there aren't objective ends in economics, just whatever goals people want, we're not questioning them. He rejects the categories normality and perversity. Sometimes people, perversity is a word you don't hear that much anymore, but although sometimes people would say certain behavior is just perverse, it violates the objective norms. But Mises says, well, this isn't really useful in praxeology, because again, what counts is what individuals choose and how they act, not whether they conform to particular standards of what's normal. If you allow me one point about English usage, remember I gave you that one about I don't like quote as a noun, to quote as a verb, the noun is quotation. Sometimes you'll hear, instead of normality, the word normalcy. I think that's not something I like to hear. I believe that the word normalcy was coined by President Warren Harding, the one who came right after Woodrow Wilson. He had a slogan, return to normalcy. But I think it's better to use normality rather than normalcy. Now, in order to understand praxeology, you don't have to agree with Mises on objective standards. For example, Rothbard didn't. Rothbard thought there were objective goods and bad. But all that's important here, Mises is clearly right, is you have to keep, if you hold that there are objective standards, you just have to keep that view out of praxeology, because if, again, you're trying to explain action, so if you're doing that, what's important is what an individual thinks is good or bad, what his own values are, not if there is something that's objectively right or wrong or good or bad. That isn't going to help you explain someone's action unless you'd have to get what the person himself views as good or bad. Now, someone might object to Mises on subjectivity of values in this way. Almost everybody cares about physical health and material well-being, and Mises thought this himself. So Mises said, people do care, people in fact care about the material well-being and prosperity. Maybe there are a few who don't, but almost everybody does. But their objective standards on what promotes health say you won't promote your health if you smoke 2 packs of cigarettes every day. That is, we could say that's not dependent on how you think about smoking. It's just an objective matter of fact that won't promote your health. So some of you will say, well, can't we distinguish between needs and wants? We could say people might want certain things objectively. We could say we could establish objectively what they need because people, everybody cares about physical health. So we could say, well, there's certain objective standards of that. But Mises doesn't accept this objection because he said, again, what's important in explaining someone's behavior is how the person acts, not whether his behavior is wise or foolish. So somebody might be, if somebody smokes a lot, he's doing something that's very bad for his health, but still, if you're trying to explain his action, it's because his end is something. He say he wants to smoke and he thinks lighting up will be a means to give him certain feelings that he wants. We could come up with all sorts of ways of explaining why the person smokes, but they would have to be based on that person's values. The fact that smoking is objectively bad for your health is irrelevant in explaining what the person is doing. Now Mises then shifts to another point that I think is a very, very important in understanding action. Remember, we got already that an action is an effort to improve a state of affairs. So you're acting because you think by acting you can change things from the better. So you could take action then as an exchange. You'd say, what would be the case? Suppose I didn't act in a particular way. You'd say, what would be the case then? So I'm exchanging that state of affairs. What would happen if I didn't act with the state of affairs where I do act? That sounds a bit confusing. That's what I try to do. I try to make things a bit confusing. From time to time, I wouldn't have tried it, but it often ends up that way. But we can make it, let's just give a simple example. Suppose I choose to eat an apple, then I'm exchanging the state of my not eating the apple for the state of affairs of my eating the apple. See, it's quite simple. It just take what is the state of affairs where I don't act, in what is the state of affairs when I do act, so I'm exchanging one for the other. Now, the state of affairs that's given up is called the price of the action. Now, this is different from prices like market prices. This is special usage of price. So it's the state of affairs that's given up, Mises has the term price for the action. So say, in my example, my not eating the apple, that state of affairs that's given up, is the price of my eating the apple. So then, Mises now introduces another term again. He's using price in a special way here. Now he's also using this other term, costs, in a special way, because the value of the price paid is called cost. So what do you mean by that? Well, remember, I'm giving up one state of affairs when I act for something else. So I'm getting something valuable, say I'm eating the apple. So eating the apple is what I'm getting. So I put some value on that. So I could also say, well, what's the value of the state without the apple? Again, that's the state without the apple is the price. That's what's given up. So the value of that is the cost. So in effect, what I'm doing when I'm making an exchange, I'm comparing two different values, the value of what I'm giving up and the value of what I'm getting. So the gain that you make from acting is your profit. Remember here, profit is not just a term that's used in business. Here it's used in any action. It's the value of what you get minus the value of what you would have done had you not acted in that way. So you would have done something else, remains where you were unchanged. So whatever would have happened, what you would have done had you not acted would give you your cost. So again, the cost is the value that you're giving up by acting. So as Mises is using it here, profit is subjective, that every actor is trying to improve things and is thus aiming at profit. So not he's not talking about profit in the sense of making a profit in business where you're trying to make money. It's just you're trying to improve things. You're trying to reach a more valuable state than the one you were in, or more valuable than the state you'd be in if you didn't act in that way. So, of course, sometimes actions don't work. Sometimes actions fail. You think something will improve things, but in fact it won't. So in that case, what would happen, you'd make less profit than you thought you would, or you'd suffer a loss. So you think, if I do such and such, it'll improve things. In fact, it doesn't improve things that much. Or you could find you've actually made things worse. Now, suppose we take a case. Suppose I say, again, I'm eating the apple, so I'm giving up the state of affairs where I'm not eating the apple for the state where I am eating the apple. So I say, well, I suppose I feel I've done the right thing. I've gained by this. So I'll have some idea of the extent that I've gained or lost by the action. But again, Mises makes a very important point here. Very important to remember this when you're studying Austrian economics, that the gain or loss, meaning this gain or loss in terms of value, like how much value I gained or lost by acting a certain way, can't be expressed in measurable units. So for praxeology, utility, meaning something like what I'm getting or happiness, what I value, is ordinal rather than cardinal. We could rank our preferences as first, second, third, so on. We can't measure preferences in units. Now, there have been attempts by psychologists to measure pleasure and pain. The famous one at Harvard, S.S. Stevens, who did all sorts of things trying to measure how much pleasure and pain people got out of various events. But these measurement scales don't apply to value judgments. In any case, Mises is rather suspicious of them. Okay, so I think that's the end. Now we'll go to the questions now. Let me see. I'll have both the Q&A and in the chat room. Okay, now I see here's something. Andrew asked on page 94, all that we can say about consumer good we apply to any good of a higher order, except those of a higher order we consider it as a product. Could you explain what Mises means by except those of the highest order? Well, let me see what, how would one explain that.
Are you talking about land or labor?
Yes, I think what he means there is the good of the highest order would be something that isn't produced, like an original factor of production, so you can't consider it as a product. You see, so that would be why you can't say, there's something you could say about these goods of a higher order that wouldn't apply to the original factors because they aren't produced. You're considering, see, what you're saying about the consumer's good is that you combine various other factors of production. You combine other things to get it. So you have your first order producer's good give you consumer's good. Now he says, you can take a producer's good and say the same thing about that. You get other things, other producer's goods that you have to combine to get that. But then you reach, you get to these original factors, they're just there. You don't produce them by combining something else to get them. They're just there. So that's what he means by good of the highest order. Okay, let me just go back now to the chat. I think there are some questions there. Now, there's one, John says, all profit in the mind. Well, here, again, I'm glad you asked that question. It's a bit confusing because profit is also used in economics in a different sense. Was definitely not in the mind. A profit, as you'll see later if you read Human Action, has to do with speculative gains that an entrepreneur is making a business. But here, Mises is talking about mental profit, meaning the value that you gain minus the value of what you're giving up. So this kind of profit is in the mind, but it isn't the same as business profit, which is a dollar or monetary amount. So that's something else. Okay. Okay, well, somebody likes my lecture. Thank you. Well, I still have 25 more minutes in the question period to ruin things. You might change your opinion to the whole thing. I mean, suppose if you like the lecture, that would still be the case. If I really do a bad job in the Q&A, but I can still do that. Oh, Danny, by the way, I sent in quiz number 4, didn't I? I think I did.
Let me check.
Because if not, I can send it in again. I have number 5 for you, but I'll send in number 4. I thought I sent it last week, but
that's right. I forwarded it to Matt and Megan.
So oh, good. Now, here's one. Discuss how praxeology deals with deontology. Oh, number 4 is posted. Oh, and someone took it already. Okay, well, deontology would be, Mises is personally not very sympathetic to deontological views. Deontology would be something like saying, you ought to do something, you ought not to do something, or something is right or wrong, where that isn't to be cashed out in terms of goals or ends that people have. Those you just have a rule, you should never lie under any circumstances. The rule would be deontological. So here's a constraint that you ought to follow. It isn't saying you should follow this rule in order to be happy, say, or you suppose somebody could have a view that if you lie frequently, that'll prevent you from living on good terms with people and you'll lead to bad results for you. That would be not a deontological view. Deontological would be saying, here's your rule. So Mises was very unsympathetic to deontological views of ethics, but someone, if you were trying to explain someone's action who held such a view, you would just treat it as a goal of that person to obey that rule. So the way I think praxeology would deal with a deontological constraint is just to take it as a goal or end of the, that the person had in acting. Now, Erica says, Andrew Robbins had an interesting question earlier. According to Bob Murphy's explanation study guide, he seems to point out the scale itself is a mental construct that only exists in the means-end framework. Is this a deeper meaning Bob is talking about? Well, I think, if I'm understanding you, I think this is what Mises was saying in the passage that I mentioned. The means-end framework is the framework of action. So the scale of values, according to me, is just known from the action. So it isn't that you have some scale of values in your mind that you can assess do people act in accord with that. It's just you get the scale from what the person has actually done. Okay, now here's one from John Galt. Time preference exists because man acts, and also do interest rate exist for any exchange, then not only money. Yes, I mean, there's as long as there's any exchange of when you have an exchange of present and future goods, then you would have a rate of interest. So there's rate of interest on all goods, not just money. Now, Kendrick says, suppose one determines their ends can be achieved by force or by law to benefit them. Suppose someone does that, what would be the rest of the question? I'm not sure. I mean, somebody could take a view, somebody could have an unethical end, but that would still be their end, you see. So again, praxeology wouldn't be saying something is good or bad, and just you're trying to explain what the person is doing. Now, Tim asked an interesting question. But tricky, is a first order produces good a second order good? So you're thinking, well, the consumer's good would be the first order good, then first order produces good would be second order good. Well, this is interesting, but see, but the problem there is that the term order of goods, where you take both consumers and producers goods, isn't used by Mises. So he doesn't talk about orders of goods, including consumers' goods. So we talk about first order producers' good is the first order, because the order is only, you're only considering producers' goods. So you could take it that way, in the way you suggest, but I don't think that's the terminology Mises uses. So Kendrick says, so praxeology doesn't deal with ethics. Yes, that's, you put that very well. That was what I was trying to point out in the lecture. Ethics is entirely distinct. discipline from praxeology. So that's an excellent point you raise. Andrew says, hope doesn't bother me to bring it up, but what is the main point of argument between you and Stevens? I haven't read Stevens' book for a while, and he's making the case for objectively true ethics. Well, it doesn't bother me less, but I really don't want to get into him right now. It's gotten me into enormous trouble, so I don't want to comment. I mean, he has a certain way of doing things, and I just say, if you're interested in that, just read it and make up your own mind about it. Now, David says, I should say, one reason I'm a bit reluctant to comment on one of the other classes I gave, someone asked me, I made some comment about him, and then the person posted it to his site, and it got me into all sorts of trouble. You know, I always avoid trouble. You can tell that from my book reviews and comments in the lecture. But if you're interested, you can just look up my review of him and my views. And now, David Scott says, Vikings traded and plundered, whichever was easier than certain that they desired goods would acquire them by theft, unless that was too costly, in which case trade was better, not ethical, but logical. Yeah, that would just be the structure, that would be the particular goals they had. So if you were explaining what they did, you would use their actual values. If they're doing something that's wrong, that wouldn't come into the explanation of what they did. Now, Kendrick said, didn't me or Rothbard believe there was no profit but only time for it? Oh, no, I mean, they would certainly both believe in profit in the same way I've explained it here, and they both believe in time for it. Now, you may be thinking of a particular construction called the evenly rotating economy, and there's no monetary profit, but that's different from what we're talking about in this lecture, which is just the profit in the sense of the gain in subjective value that you get when you attain a certain end. Now, Danny says, it means we say the Vikings have been aware of a great productivity of peaceful division of labor. They would have chosen otherwise. Yes, I think he probably would say that. Yes, now Kendrick says, yes, ERE. Yes, I mean, they would both think there's no monetary profit in the ERE, but remember, that, when they talk about profit there, that has nothing to do with profit in the way I talk about in this lecture. It is a bit confusing that it's the same term, but this is just, profit here is just a subjective category that applies to all action. What they're talking about there is monetary profit. So the basic thing is why there's no monetary profit in the ERE, this kind of profit there is profit from adjusting things that the entrepreneur sees that there's sort of a lack that he could change things around in a way that'll get things closer to their true market values. But in the ERE, all the adjustments have been made, so there's no profit in that sense, but there's still profit the way we're talking about here, as long as there's action, as long as there's people making action that they're not viewing as mistaken. So Kendrick says, the problem in this instance, I know it's personal gain due to preference in a particular transaction. Yes, exactly. That's exactly right. Good. Now, Andrew says, how does Rothbard differ Mises in terms of ethical? It wasn't Mises utilitarian. Yes, that's right. Mises was a utilitarian, at least in this broad sense of someone who believed that the end, the main goal of ethics is to promote social cooperation through the free market. And Rothbard, and again, he didn't believe that was objectively right or good, because he didn't believe that there were things that were objectively good apart from people's valuation, but he thought everybody wants peace and prosperity, and free market is the way to get that. Now, Rothbard was a believer in natural law, so he thought there were objective goods in ethics, but their practical conclusions were very similar. Now, David says, why do we not care that society is better overall with division of labor if theft and plunder remain easier means of acquiring personal immediate wealth, individual act and have time. Well, it might be, though, that they could think, it might be the division of labor would be such benefit that it would help even them. I mean, you're right, they would, they might not. I mean, that's difficult to say. Now, Erica says, quick way to sum up, in the area, people earn wages, rent, interest, income, society problem, not an entrepreneurial problem. I think that's a very good way of putting it, yes. But remember, we're not going to be getting to the ERA in this course because we're only on the first part of human action. We have to leave that to the economists to get to the ERE. So we never get to the ERE in the real world, and we don't get there in this course either. Now, Bob says, how many human action courses are you going to offer? Well, their U is ambiguous. Do you mean how many are going to be offered by the Mises Academy, or how many am I going to offer? As far as I know, I'm going to offer just this part one, and other parts will be dealt with, given by other people like Joe Salerno, Guido Holtzma, but I don't know exactly how many of them. That would be something Danny Sanchez would be deciding. Now, David says we're not going to be getting to the area in this lifetime either. Yes, it's just a purely mental construct. It's not something that's actually attained. You're right. Now, Danger, Newton, Rothbard, Fong, Bombardier said about the classical economists call long-run profit is really interest. Yes, interest is the rate of return on capital, which is given by the rate of time preference combined with some other things. But profit is used in Austrian economics in the business sense, with just particular ways where there's some sort of gap between demand and supply of various goods, and someone comes along and says he can get money by adjusting things. Yes, that's right. The time value of money. Yes, that's right. Now, Andrew said, do you find people new to economics commonly confuse capital goods with financial capital? I find this distinction confusing when people just use the term capital. Yes, that's an extremely important distinction between capital goods and capital as kind of the monetary value of all these goods. And this is one that's discussed later in Human Action, this distinction. People fall into a lot of mistakes because they neglect that. So you're anticipating something that Mises is going to be discussing later in the book, but not in the chapters we'll be dealing with in this course. Now, Jeff says, could you explain what Mises means by a category? Well, a category, I think, as Mises is using, is kind of a broad concept or idea that we have that's essential to the way we look at the world. Like, say, we have the category of cause and effect, causality. We couldn't understand the world unless we had the concept of something or some person bringing something about. So a category would be a concept we have that's necessary to understand the world, a broad concept. We wouldn't say table is a concept we have, but it isn't a category because it's not one of these very broad abstract constructs that we need to understand the world. So category is just kind of these basic concepts that are essential to the way we conceive the world. And John says, can praxeology be used to predict? If you mean predicting what particular people are going to do, no. I'm praxeology is giving you general characteristics of all action. So you can't predict particular outcomes. I mean, you might be able to make predictions in the sense that, say, if people legislate minimum wage laws, then there'll be more unemployment than there otherwise would have been. So you might be able to make predictions in that sense, but not of specific actions. If you could sum up Keynesian economics in one word, what would it be? Oh, I don't know, maybe. That, maybe inflation, I don't know. Danger within the category, action could not be including, yes, that's right. But idiotic, awesome. Idiotic for, okay, well, but you see, there are all sorts of things that are idiotic. That wouldn't distinguish Keynesian economics from other sorts of things that you might characterize in that way. Well, again, illogical. See, what you need to do, though, if you're talking about Keynesian economics, you need to give something that's specifically characteristic of it. Not, there are all sorts of things that are illogical, but again, that wouldn't be a good one-word summary. I mean, you want to give something that the person would have some idea of what Keynesian economics was. I don't think you could sum it up in one word, but that would be what you'd be trying to do, I think. How about one word for Austrian economics? Well, now that Danny says that it confuses the roles of consumption and production. Yes, that's an interesting way of looking at things. Yes, I mean, it does see the economy as driven by spending rather than emphasize production. I think that's a very good point. Kendra says, any word about credits and suggestions? Well, I think Danny will be in charge of that. I don't handle credits and certificates, just cash, not credit. Oh, good. John thinks I'm funny. Good for you. Check is in the mail. Yes, as long as it's sent to me. So Bob says, I can't use it. She says, I'm not responsible for my action. Well, you can. I mean, whether it's true or not is something else, but you can certainly say that. I have a praxeology. Okay, well, I think we're about out of time now. So thanks very much, everybody. Thank you. Hope to see next week will be lecture number 6. Okay, thank you, everybody. Hope to see you next week.